Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, and I'm joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, DACA in the dock. And Richard, revisiting today the topic of DACA, something we haven't talked about for a while. And enough times passed that our listeners may have forgotten that that acronym stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. This is the policy put in place by President Obama via executive order that was protecting people who were brought into the country illegally as children from deportation. Wouldn't have given them a path to citizenship necessarily. But this, of course, came in the wake of President Obama saying at several points publicly that it was not within his power to act unilaterally on this, that he was, and this was the quote, not a king. But when his administration did eventually take action, they did so under the aegis of prosecutorial discretion, essentially said, it's not that we're ignoring the law, it's just that we have limited resources with which to enforce it, and these people who came over as kids aren't really huge enforcement priorities. How legally defensible a case was that for the Obama administration to make?
It's a very difficult problem. First of all, there's no question that as a statutory matter, the criminal code contains all sorts of offenses, some greater, some lesser. And it is also the case that prior to his decision with respect to DACA, they managed to do enforcement actions with respect to many of these activities having to do with illegal aliens, probably even illegal children. So it does mark a change in policy. It means that you cannot say that you absolutely have to positively do this because you had done it the other way. On the other hand, if you start to think that, generally speaking, you ought to go after serious crimes first and less serious crimes second, there's a kind of a brute logic to this. The traditional view with respect to this is that you could make these decisions on a case-by-case basis or on a group-by-group basis, but the groups could never be essentially 700,000 people representing all children who are brought illegally into the country. There is also the piece of rhetoric, which I always want to refer to, is we try to make the problem easy by saying they're undocumented aliens. The statutory term is illegal, and the reason why the word undocumented is a much more pleasant term to use is it avoids the stark confrontation associated with the situation, because there's always the hope that even though you're undocumented, you're still in some other sense legal. But if you simply use the statutory term, there's no way that you could be legal and illegal at the same time. That said, on the political side, I think that I strongly supported the Obama situation. I can't think of a better class of citizens to be made than those people who came here as children. These are people who have served the United States very well. They are acculturated. Many of them have no place to go back home to. It would be an absolute horror. And I would strongly support any sensible form of congressional action which would bring this thing to pass. The great tragedy is there was an effort to try and do this when Trump first became president, and it took the form of we'll keep a standstill agreement with respect to DACA. You give us some money for my wall, and we could kind of make that a deal. I would have taken that deal in a second. Not that I'm a fan of the wall, but I think that the DACA just absolutely dominates that in terms of its importance. But the Democrats made a mistake in my judgment. They pushed too hard. They wanted to treat DACA as a path to citizenship. My view is that issue should have been decided separately and later. First, you basically return to the status quo ante, and then you figure out what adjustments you want to make on the citizenship side, independent of the wall question. So I think that this was, to some extent, mishandled by Obama. And so as you come to the Supreme Court, what you do is you have a Trump administration, which can say quite truthfully, the reason that we are no longer enforcing this particular program or respecting this program is we have a former president of the United States who said, I don't have the power to do this. And you know what? He was right when he said it. And everybody understands that it was mere political convenience when he went the other way through an executive order. The Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away. If he can put this in by way of executive order, no questions asked, we could take it out by an executive order, no questions asked, which is one of the many positions that you could possibly take in this case, and certainly one which is talked about and bandied about on the recent hearing before the United States Supreme Court.
Okay, so what about that? Because there's a couple of different arguments that are being offered before the court. One of them speaks directly to this issue, And it's the Trump administration's position that this is not even necessarily something that's justiciable, that, that this is not subject to judicial review because it was, as you say, done unilaterally by the Obama administration. Trump administration says totally within our rights to do exactly the same in the opposite direction. And that's executive branch business. Courts don't even have a role in adjudicating it. How much sympathy do you have for that argument?
It turns out that on the Trump side, I have a lot of sympathy with respect to that position. But on the Obama side, I have much less respect for that position. The Obama Act was known by him when he did it to have been illegal, notwithstanding the fact that all the prosecutorial discretion arguments could have been made when he made his recognition of the illegality. And so when he does this by executive order, it turns out to be a usurpation of power. When Trump comes in and does it by executive order, the idea that he's going to be subject to greater scrutiny to remove something that's illegal than the man who put it into places strikes me as very, very bizarre. And so when all the lower courts come through and concede that he has the power in some way to do it, but has to give forth a set of adequate reasons judged by them, and of course no reasons are going to be adequate if you're deeply in favor of the particular program, it seems to me that that's probably a mistake. My guess is that the case may well come out on the fudge ground, which is, well, the president has grounds that are certainly adequate, so he could remove it. I actually think the correct position, I'm sorry to say, is the harder line, which is that I think, in fact, if the order was illegal, you don't have to give an explanation beyond pointing to the illegality to say, in fact, that it cannot be enforced. It's a peculiar kind of asymmetry. Nobody required Obama to go through an APA proceeding when he put this into place. And now when he wants to get rid of it, that is when Trump wants to get rid of it, all of a sudden the Administrative Procedure Act seems to be front and center in the deliberations. I actually thought that this would have been a relatively easy case if what you were doing is worried about the legalities of the situation, an impossibly difficult one if you're worried about the politics. But the lower courts made it rather difficult. And it's pretty clear if you start listening to the argument that people like Sotomayor are dead set against having anything change with that. I mean, I think their view is once you open the door, you can never shut it again. Another way of putting it is no matter how exhaustive the reasons you give, we will always find them inadequate, so we'll send it back again and again and again, and then maybe 5 years down the road, you'll get a political situation solving it through legislation in Congress, but otherwise, no. So, I mean, I do think that there are the rejectionists who will go that far. My guess is that the conservative five will hold. I don't know whether they're going to do it on the narrow holding or on the broader holding. They will face a lot more political fire if they do it on the broad illegality holding. They will have much more intellectual difficulty if they try to do it on the narrower grounds, because it turns out the arguments for that are, I think, a little bit more dicey. That is, I don't see any way to treat this as an APA hearing, even though that's the way in which there are large numbers of people who would hope would come out. And again, you know, I say this with my heart in my mouth, because I think that this DACA thing should have been solved years ago. And I think it should have been solved in exactly the way in which the defenders of the young dreamers are trying to get it solved. But, you know, this is Lex Dorr said law, Lex, which means it's a tough law, but it's law. This is one of these cases where you really have to face that. The statutes are reasonably clear. I think that selective prosecution argument really doesn't work, particularly if you're going to raise it only in the sixth or seventh year of the Obama administration and have not uniformly done it. Somebody could say, hey, you had selection beforehand. What you do is you have to pick the best within each category. You cannot simply eliminate an entire category. That's repeal of legislation. It's not prosecutorial discretion. This is a very controversial argument. I think that's probably the right answer. But boy, oh boy, sometimes when I wake up, I say, you can't be serious, Richard. You don't really mean that. And then I go back to sleep again. And I say, I probably do.
Just to make clear for a moment, you referenced in there a couple of times the Administrative Procedure Act. Our listeners who aren't that familiar with this area of law may be asking themselves, well, why is it that the courts get to weigh in on whether the justification the administration puts forward meets their standards? But it has its origins in that statute. Can you just explain for us for a moment what the executive branch is obligated to under that law?
Using the word just a moment, it's extremely difficult to figure out all of this stuff. But, I mean, you have to go back to 1937. And what you do is you start to see that there is now a massive expansion of federal power in terms of the subjects matter that you can deal with and the way in which you can deal with them. So take an area which actually prompted the adoption of the APA, or at least some of its provisions. What are you supposed to do about labor law? And it turned out to get the New Deal sustaining the National Labor Relations Act and the Fair Labor Standards Act, and these have huge delegations to administrators. And it turned out during the war and afterwards, there was a clear sense on the part of Republicans, surely, and on many Democrats, particularly Southern Democrats, that the whole system had essentially gone haywire. And so right after the war, when people could turn their attention to this issue again, they start to say, what we really need to do is to have a constitutive stack, which will tell us how we run an administrative system once we've legitimated the New Deal. And so what they do is they pass this very complicated statute, which contains as one of its centerpieces a judicial review of administrative action. And what happens is, well, what kinds of administrative actions are going to be covered by this? And it's clear that you cannot, subject to review through the courts in the APA, a decision of the president to relocate troops from one base to another base. It turns out that you certainly don't want the appointment of ambassadors to be subject to judicial review of one kind or another. So what you do is you carve out lots of things that essentially fall within the sphere of the presidential power, including many things that relate to foreign relations, which is why in the earlier case of Trump v. Hawaii, when it turned out that Trump decided that he was going to pull back on who could come in and require certain investigations of certain kinds of non-residents trying to come into the United States, the statutory authority was enormous, and the only question was to the extent that you could limit it by pointing to terrible motivations that the president had expressed during the campaign, and by a 5-4 vote, what they decided is Trump had managed to sanitize himself from his own bigotries by the way in which he had gone through elaborate procedures to see how these rules would actually work, and had relied in many ways on Obama precedents with respect to the same people and the same kinds of issues. So we don't know exactly where executive power begins and where executive power ends. There was a famous article in 2001 by Elena Kagan, and what she did is she had just come out of the Trump administration, and she had kind of made it sort of clear is that
Clinton
The Clinton administration. No, thank you. I don't think Elena was in the other one. And she wrote this thing on presidential power, and the whole question is exactly how much you could do by executive order. And she took the position that you could push it pretty far. Then it turns out that you have George Bush, and he takes the same attitude in connection with signing statements. He says, yes, you can pass this law. I'm not going to veto it. But by the way, I want you to know I'm not compromising on this, that, and the other issues. And so already you have yet another confrontation between Congress and the president. Obama takes that even further, and Trump, to some extent, actually doesn't go as far as Obama, but he goes plenty far. So we don't know exactly where the line is. The way it came up in this particular case is it was quite clear that Obama said, I can only do this by executive action. I can't find a way to get a hearing through various kinds of agencies dealing with immigration to get it done. And so the basic rule that we have in the United States is that which is done by executive order can be undone by executive order, leaving open the question of what it is that could be done by executive order in the first place. So when you have a government as vast and as complicated as ours, to try and see if you could figure out how you find watertight compartments between executive, legislative, and judicial action is extremely difficult, especially when you have an administrative state which has both executive branch agencies that are not independent of the president, that he could fire its chief people. And since Humphrey's executives, you have independent agencies like the FCC and the FTC and so forth and the SEC, where you don't have that automatic power removal. So the Administrative Procedure Act is an important first step on this, but what's happened is nobody actually kind of really knows what the answer is, which is why it is that we are now 73 years past the 1943 passage of this particular statute, and questions that seem to be so elementary turn out to give rise to such a huge difference of opinion. The three positions basically cover the universe. It turns out the thing was illegal. The president could just get rid of it. It turns out the thing was illegal. The president has to give reasons, but he has given reasons. And it turns out the thing is illegal. But once it's in place, the reliance interest on the part of the various dreamers is so strong that you can't get rid of it unless you could figure out how it is that you're going to protect them in some way. I mean, it is amazing as to how much is at stake in administrative law. And that's exactly why, coming up at this moment, the scope of the administrative state's power is, I think, the number one issue in the political arena and on the Supreme Court. As you know, since you were involved in it, I did write this little book called The Dubious Morality of the Administrative Law, which expresses in a systematic fashion some of my large misgivings about many of the issues dealing with delegation and deference and so forth. And the reason it's in play is because everybody knows that the current synthesis is not stable in the sense that they're likely to be major changes, and you don't quite know which way they're going to go and who's going to bring them. So this case, in effect, has to be seen as a small piece in a large mosaic, which has all these other things around it. My guess is it will be 5-4 on the legality issue, but I only give myself a 55% confidence, so I can always say, I didn't tell you so, I just speculated.
In closing, let me get you to react to sort of a broader criticism of how the Trump administration handles these kinds of cases. Garrett Epps, a con law professor at the University of Baltimore, just published a piece in The Atlantic where he argues that one of the hallmarks of the Trump administration has been how sloppy it's handling some of these cases have been. So he points to the early iterations of the travel ban, which you mentioned, that got knocked down in the courts. He talks about how weak the Commerce Department's rationale for adding the citizenship question to the census was, to the point where they lost Chief Justice Roberts on that one. Here's Epps. Let me read you the quote. In area after area, bad lawyering and contempt for the rule of law have resulted in Trump initiatives being derailed in the lower courts. The judges in these cases have usually not ruled that Trump's policies are unconstitutional. Instead, the flaws that show up over and over arise from incompetent reading of federal statutes and willful failure to follow prescribed procedures. Administrative law is hard, to be sure, but the executive branch employs good lawyers, really, really smart and careful lawyers who love it. They can provide political appointees with good advice on how to achieve their goals, but over and over, the administration has cut these good lawyers out of the loop and paid bitterly for it in court. Fair criticism, Richard?
I think it's a bit overwrought. Let me give you an example of some things that start to go the other way. If you wanted to talk about abuses under the Obama administration, one of them was, of course, the guidance. And the dear colleague, Leffert Wetter, became a sort of an element of terror in the way in which we started to do things. It was also the case that when you looked at the rules for the waters of the United States, there was huge overreach on the part of the Obama administration. When it came out to what it is that we mean by best available equipment for dealing with various kinds of environmental stuff, the environmental stuff with respect to the Clean Act there under the Obama administration way over the top. I think Mr. Epps has to talk about those things. If you actually look at the lawyering on those that was put forward by the Obama administration, some of it was really excellent. Just to mention one thing is they put out a pair of executive orders, which essentially undid the Obama executive order on the question of how we use guidance. And they were both first-rate documents, carefully done, properly executed. To give you another illustration, one of the terrible things that the Obama administration had done was to contrive all sorts of fake rationales to refuse to acknowledge what the Army Corps of Engineers did when it approved the DAPL, that is the Dakota Access Pipeline, carrying about 500,000 barrels of crude oil from the Bakken oil fields down to Illinois. Their executive orders there were super. The Obama people were unspeakably sloppy, downright dishonest, totally inept in the way in which they started to deal with these things. So I think what you have to do is to ask yourself, you know, which way do we want to work on these things? Just to give you another illustration, the Obama administration was absolutely unpardonably sloppy when it came to the question about the FISA warrants that it was prepared to issue in order to sabotage the Trump campaign. They were baseless, and it was known to be such. Exactly how that plays into the election results, I'm not going to comment on now. But you get a lot of sloppiness in the other area, and you get some very good stuff coming out of the Trump administration. Essentially, the administration outlawed their opposition because they understood just how much of a deep hole Trump had put them into. And what they did is they let the guys who were running the programs do with it. I would say there is the following important distinction that you have to make. There is Donald Trump, erratic, irascible, sometimes right, often wrong. And then there's his administration. when the administration is let to go ahead without independence from the president as such, these are exceptionally able people. You know, many of them, I'm happy to say, are my former students. Some of them are already becoming judges one kind or another. But, you know, Noah Francisco and Jeff Wall, both terrific guys. I've had two recent people in the administration, Rachel Kovner and Martha Packle, both becoming district court judges, one in the Eastern District of New York, one in Illinois and so forth, the Northern District. These are terrific people. And so I just think that what happens is you have to be much more careful when you start to make a kind of denunciation like that to give yourself a baseline. The difference between it is the Obama guys were very smooth, but often very, very wrong. Sometimes the Trump people are a little bit more brusque, at least when he starts to speak publicly, and sometimes when his key people do. But in fact, there's some very good lawyering going on in the Trump administration, as well as some very bad lawyering. In the case at hand with respect to DACA, I don't think anybody could say that the charge that he wants to make would be regarded as true. Noel Francisco got up there, and he certainly held his own with respect to the way in which the argument had made, and is probably going to prevail. So this is a constant problem, but if you start looking at large swaths of cases, I don't think that you would find that the Trump administration, even though it has certainly had some howlers, has done systematically worse than the Obama administration, which has also had some very, very grievous errors. Indeed, it's not only that. You go back earlier, George Bush had some problems, and certainly when you got to the Clinton administration, there were also some very serious difficulties. It's extremely difficult when you have so much power in administrative law to make sure that when you have politically motivated actors of either party, that they're always going to stick to the straight and narrow. That's what us law professors are supposed to do. We're supposed to ignore politics, and sometimes we get consumed by it.
All right. Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can read Richard's column. It's called The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org. And you can follow him on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. And if you enjoy the podcast, please rate it on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.